Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Wayne Wiegand, co-author of The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, Civil Rights and Local Activism. We'll also hear from novelist Silas House, whose new book is Southernmost. Wayne Wiegand is F. William Summers Professor of Library and Information Studies Emerita and Professor of American Studies at Florida State University. His new book, written with his wife Shirley, is a fascinating account of a relatively little-known chapter in library history and the civil rights movement. It's called The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, Civil Rights and Local Activism. Wayne and Shirley will be in New Orleans for the American Library Association Conference and a very special event at the New Orleans Public Library. Wayne's speaking to us today from his home in California. Wayne Wiegand, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be with you.
What a page-turner of a book. There's so much history here. So how did you first become interested in library desegregation?
Well, it actually arose out of the research I was doing on a previous book I wrote entitled Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. And as I was going through the digitized newspaper databases, I focused a bit particularly on the black newspaper databases, which when I simply used the phrase public library to search all of those pages of those black newspapers, the story just sort of emerged out of that. What I was discovering was that in many instances, public library protests were generally being ignored by the white press in the South or overlooked by the national press outside the South. But the black newspaper editors were watching it, and they would call down to people who were participating in these protests and get quotes, which was really wonderful for us as historians to be able to incorporate into the narrative of the book. So that's where a lot of that information came from, was the research on Part of Our Lives. After knowing what we've discovered, that this was a story that had to be told, because these people, the folks that protested in the public libraries, really generally had been overlooked by Southern historians as well as civil rights historians.
And you like writing that kind of bottom-up history, don't you, with actual accounts by library users?
Yeah, that's a favorite approach of mine and my wife, Cheryl. Often when history is written, it's written from the perspective of the more powerful people. And these were kids, literally kids,
yeah,
who challenged Jim Crow laws in public libraries in the South. And it was fun to tell their story.
And you'll be telling a lot about that at the ALA, I know. Now, many of these desegregation efforts took place in some of the well-known cities of the civil rights movement, Selma, Birmingham, Jackson, although the library information isn't as well-known as other actions. And you really flesh that out.
Yeah, what happens after a period of time, as more and more civil rights protests occurred, the national media tended to follow the leaders of the civil rights movements, people like Martin Luther King Jr., Stokely Carmichael, Ralph Abernathy, etc. But those folks didn't necessarily participate in the protests of the public libraries. So that's how the national media tended to overlook what was happening in those public library protests. In Birmingham, for example, it was during that violent summer that Martin Luther King was jailed and wrote his letter from the Birmingham jail that several kids went into the Birmingham Public Library and they challenged the Jim Crow library system there, and they successfully defeated it. In fact, within several days of having held a reading protest, the Board of Trustees of the Birmingham Public Library decided to go ahead and integrate. Well, it did it so quietly that that incident was never picked up by the national media, which was focusing on Bull Connor's fire-hosing kids and sicking dogs on them. That's what got into the nation's newspapers, not the Birmingham Public Library desegregation effort. Nonetheless, the kids who went in there were just as frightened of being bitten by dogs or being fire-hosed outside the public library as the protesters elsewhere in Birmingham.
Now tell us a bit about the Tougaloo Nine, for example.
The Tougaloo Nine is a favorite group of mine, certainly. Cheryl enjoyed doing the research on them, too. Tougaloo College resides a few miles outside of Jackson, Mississippi. And in the early 1960s, Medgar Evers, a civil rights icon, certainly, who was assassinated in the early 1960s, organized a youth NAACP group. Scores of kids, of Tougaloo students, well, he decided that the Jackson Public Library was a good place to stage a protest, and it would be the first civil rights protest in the state of Mississippi. And about 24 kids identified themselves as willing to test that Jim Crow practice. And of that 24, nine were selected because they had the right personalities. That is, they were determined, but they also recognized that they could not react if violence was occasioned upon them. So those nine then went into the Jackson Public Library and challenged Jim Crow practices. They were immediately arrested and carted off to jail. They all have really wonderful stories to tell, and I'm glad to say at least one of them will be with us at the June 24th program at the New Orleans Public Library.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me is that a lot of these stories seem to follow a kind of arc. There's first entering the library, requesting a library card or books or some other material, then early demonstrations, resistance against being confined to segregated libraries. There are even segregated bookmobiles, which I found incredibly fascinating.
Right there in your state of Louisiana.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then shutdowns and litigation and then kind of quiet after the fact desegregation.
One must always remember about public libraries that they are not compulsory institutions. People don't have to use them, whereas people generally have to go to schools. Education is compulsory, and in the South, certainly the effort to desegregate public schools was much more violent than the effort to desegregate public libraries. Generally, public libraries were perceived in many communities as just one step to prove that the local white establishment was willing to compromise, and that's because of that non-compulsory nature to the public library. So you don't see violence occurring as much in public library desegregation as you do in public school desegregation.
I always think of the library as the great democratic space. You know, I just do. Oh, now one of the things you do so well in this book, in addition to the fine scholarship of Reconstruction and dates and names and places, but you make us feel the indignity of being denied access to these democratic spaces. That photograph on the cover of James Bradford sitting at a library table with policemen standing over him, that's utterly chilling.
Actually, that photograph was taken from a video that I think was shot by a local Jackson TV station, but never aired. Now, I'm not exactly certain about that. We discovered that video, which captures all of the Tougaloo Nine filing into the library and filing out of the library and being arrested by those very same police officers you see on the front cover of the book. That's part of our PowerPoint presentation, which we'll be giving in New Orleans at the public library. But yes, the indignities that they suffered. Now, I wouldn't credit us so much with focusing on the indignities as being able to quote the people who suffered those indignities. Mm-hmm. And that's in part because we had all those wonderful quotes from the black press and from the memories that these young black protesters eventually worked into books and articles and newspaper interviews.
And they were so young and so fearful, but they were so brave. I mean, that comes through all the way in this book.
Yeah. One of the persons who will be with us in New Orleans, for example, Ibrahim Moochman, who as a 15-year-old Charlie Porter was arrested in Columbus, Georgia. The police specifically took him aside. He was the youngest of the protesters. And in the police station, specifically took him aside and grilled him for 3 hours. So here's this kid, 15-year-old kid, being separated from his 17-year-old brother and his brother's colleagues who were 17, 18, and 19, deliberately being separated because of his youth. And you can imagine the fear he had because he knew what Jim Crow around him was doing to black people.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had kind of been looking for the New Orleans Public Library in this book, but our libraries desegregated rather quickly and quietly.
Yeah, and through the brilliant political strategy of Dillard University President Albert Dent.
Absolutely.
he watched what was happening, particularly in Fort Worth, Texas, and Dallas, Texas, where the public libraries there desegregated quietly also. He got in contact with several people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for advice and counsel, and they gave him some advice. And he decided what he would do is see if he could get people representing different religions, Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic, to spearhead an effort to convince the board of the New Orleans Public Library to go ahead and integrate. It happened before the Supreme Court issued its Brown versus the Board of Education decision in 1954, and because the city establishment was recognizing that that decision would have a major impact on Jim Crow practices in the South, the whole thing sort of came together. When the Brown decision was handed down, the New Orleans Public Library Board of Trustees had already listened to the clergy talk about desegregating the library. They said, let's go ahead and do it, but they had already arranged with Albert Dent to do it quietly so that there was no publicity in the local newspapers, and the word just spread quietly among black colleges and black high schools to show up at the library, and you could use the services there. So everything was quiet, and by political strategy that Albert Dent had crafted.
And we should also mention the great efforts of the great Rosa Keller, who has a library named in her honor, of course. She's in the book.
Constantly a thorn in the side of New Orleans Public Library board members saying, we've got to desegregate this public library system.
Yes, I love her. Now, you're going to have some very special panelists at this discussion on Sunday. Tell us a little bit about them.
I can bring you up to date. Ibrahim Moochman of the Columbus, Georgia experience I mentioned earlier, he will be there to share his experiences at the Columbus, Georgia Public Library in 1963. We'll also have Robert A. Williams, who was a 15-year-old kid challenging the Danville, Virginia Public Library. We'll have Ethel Sawyer Adolph, who is one of the Tougaloo Nine. And finally, we'll have Joan Madison Daniel, who was one of the Greenville Eight and participated in the protest at which Jesse Jackson, actually, that was his first civil rights protest. So all four of those will be there with us. We'll give the general comments, general history of the library desegregation activities, but they're going to bear witness to their personal unique experiences and the emotions that they had while they were undertaking these public library protests. We're delighted that they're going to be there.
Oh, that's great. We've been talking with Wayne Wiegand, who with his wife Shirley Wiegand is the author of The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, Civil Rights and Local Activism. You can meet them along with a wonderfully distinguished panel Sunday, June 24th at 2 at the New Orleans Public Library Main Branch. Wayne, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Silas House is the author of 5 novels, including A Parchment of Leaves, Clay's Quilt, The Cold Tattoo, as well as one of my very favorites, Eli the Good, a wonderful young adult novel. We're talking with him today about his newest work, which is popping up on must-read lists all over the place, and for good reason. It's called Southernmost. Silas House, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, in Southernmost, you move around your usual territory in Appalachia, but Then your characters head to Key West, which is about as southern as it gets. It's a road novel in part. It's an escape for a father named Asher Sharp, who's desperate to keep his son Justin in the wake of a divorce. So would you give us the background for what sets these events in motion?
Well, Asher is an evangelical preacher, and when his brother comes out to him, he rejects him in a very bad way, and his brother disappears. And so Asher spends about the next 10 years studying that and evolving on that issue. And when a devastating flood hits the community, it's the impetus for him to finally have this moment where he stands up and says, I am no longer going to condone this judgment, because his wife turns away to a gay couple who are homeless because of the flood. And so that sets everything into motion.
Now, you said Asher's ministry was evangelical, and that's the tradition you grew up in. And it is fascinating to read a novel about the conflict between faith and sexual politics. How has that played out in your life? You're obviously a person of faith.
Yeah, well, it's been, you know, a long evolution for me to go from being raised in a community, a culture that has told me I'm not worthy of God, to being somebody who accepts myself and, you know, is able to be a person of faith and be comfortable with that. Every novel I write, I'm sort of asking questions of myself, trying to learn something. And so I think this novel helped me in that process a lot. It's been a lifelong thing. One thing when you're writing about evangelical characters like this, you know, is I wanted to make sure I wasn't creating any kind of caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that the evangelical characters are just as complex as the people in the book who are embracing acceptance and kindness and all those things, you know. So that's something I really strived for, because I know those people. I have had a lot of love from those people.
One of the things I loved is Asher's changing ability to pray. You know, the old ways of praying weren't working for him. And so he was trying simpler things like please, 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 or help. You know, those simple prayers that people have found are the oldest, the most basic, the truest expression of human need.
Absolutely. I always laugh a little when I'll hear people praying about, you know, a basketball game
or, right.
or a new car or something like that. And so I really wanted to have Asher be sort of the opposite of that, in that his prayers are very, you know, they're meditations and they are not selfish prayers. They're just, they're pleas. And so, yeah, that's something I really love in the book, that the idea of prayer, it goes all throughout there. And his little boy has his own idea of prayer, too, that I really identify with.
Oh, absolutely. Now, speaking of that, you know, Justin is this young boy who goes with his father but misses his mother. It's a very complex and winning character, just like Eli in Eli the Good. He's wise beyond his years. He's observant of adults. He's seeking his own kind of spiritual truths. And you write these young boys so well. Do you draw from your own childhood when you do that?
Yeah, I think when I was growing up, I was alone a lot. I was an only child. I had a lot of cousins, you know, that I sort of roamed the woods with. But often I would, even if we started out roaming together, I would end up on a creek bank somewhere with a book by myself. And I was just, you know, very sensitive, like these little boys. And so I think that two things you need for characters, you need them to be outsiders to some degree, and you need trouble. And so Justin's trouble is his weirdness and how he is different. And so that really, I can relate to that, you know, even as an adult, having an artistic sensibility, and I still have that sort of outsider feeling.
Well, I wonder if you'd read this chapter, The Everything for Us. It gives us an insight into the way Justin thinks about the world, and it is so beautiful. It's like a poem.
Yes, I'd love to. This is one of my favorite sections from the book. I appreciate you asking me to read it. Justin used to think the trees were God, but today, right here, he thinks the ocean might be God. All that power and weakness spread out for us to see. The ocean can do so much when it wants to. And sometimes it can can do nothing but go in and out, waves and smoothness. The ocean is a mystery, and so is God. They are both so big we cannot see all of them at the same time, but we can catch pieces of them here and there. Justin believes God is big like the ocean, even bigger, but lots of people don't. They think he's small enough to fit in a church house, or an offering plate, or an ancient book. He's not, and his mind is even bigger than him. People look at the ocean, and they usually see only blueness, but there are so many other colors. Right now, Justin can see 10 different shades of blue and lots of greens. There are lines of brown in the white lips of the waves. When the light hits the water in a certain way, there will be even more colors, red, orange, peach, purple. At night, there will be gray, and the farther he could swim out into the ocean, he could find the water darker and darker until it was black on a cloudy night. Justin thinks God's eyes are that color, every color. This is the kind of talk that would horrify his mother, but he believes God is in everything and everybody, pieces of him. He doesn't just mean the spirit. He means the actual chunks of God. He thinks he's not only in the ocean, but also in his dog, Shady, and the sand and the trees and every person on this beach. Every person in the world. Today, right this minute, Justin can see nothing but ocean, and that is everything. And Justin can feel the everything beneath his hand, where he is resting his palm on Shady's chest, and Shady's heart thrums in a steady rhythm, like the waves on the beach. He can feel the everything under himself in the gritty sand. He can smell it in the seaweedy smell smoothing over his face. He can hear it in the laughter of the teenagers down the beach, and in the crying of that baby, and the metal sound of the airplane sliding over them all, and the water coming in and out, the ocean is God, but so are we all. But this isn't the kind of thing he can say out loud to anyone. He knows it's the kind of talk he can say to himself in his own mind when he is sitting on a beach 1,000 miles from home, not knowing what will come next.
Oh, how I love this kid. I do.
I mean, oh, thank you. I really loved him, too.
I can tell.
8 years with him.
We've been talking with Silas House, whose beautiful new novel is Southernmost. You can meet him Thursday, June 21st at 6 when he appears in conversation with novelist Morgan Babst at Garden District Bookshop. Silas, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll see you there.
Long afloat on shipless oceans, I did all my best to smile.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Barbara Yule and Teresa Toulouse discuss and sign their co-edited book of essays, Sweet Spots, In Between Spaces in New Orleans, Sunday, June 17th at 3:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Caleb Johnson discusses and signs his novel Treeborn with Katie Simpson Smith, Tuesday, June 19th at 6 at Turkey and the Wolf, 739 Jackson Avenue, which will be serving a menu inspired by the book. The event is sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Paul Kix discusses The Saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commander. That's Tuesday, June 19th at the National World War II Museum's Louisiana Memorial Pavilion. There will be a reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Curtis Manning discusses and signs The History of Higher Education in Louisiana, Tuesday, June 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Novelist Spencer Wise discusses and signs The Emperor of Shoes with novelist Kent Wascom, Wednesday, June 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Silas House discusses his new book, Southernmost, with Morgan Babst, Thursday, June 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dogfish Reading Series presents Brett Martin and Jay Nichelle, reading their work Thursday, June 21st at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Children's author and illustrator Corinna Lykin signs The Book of Mistakes, Thursday, June 21st at 11 at Octavia Books. Ruth Spiro signs her Baby Love Science series at 1, followed by Leslie Helikowski, who signs her picture book, Ready or Not, Wolpert Goes to School. That's at 2:30, Thursday, June 21st. The American Library Association meets here in New Orleans, June 21st through 26th. For information, check out ala.org. Featured speakers include former First Lady Michelle Obama at the opening ceremony, actress Viola Davis at the closing ceremony, poet laureate Tracy K. Smith and poet Jose Antonio Vargas, biographer Jonathan Eich, journalist Robert Fiesler, actress Sally Field, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, Librarian of Congress Carla Hayden, and National Archivist Richard Ferrero. Art Club presents Pamela DeBar, best-selling author of I'm with the Band, Confessions of a Groupie, and Let It Bleed, How to Write a Rockin' Memoir. There'll be writing workshops Saturday, June 23rd and Sunday, June 24th from 1 to 5. For registration information and fees, visit pameladebar.net/events. The 4th Annual Jefferson Parish Library Mystery Readers and Writers Literary Festival takes place June 23rd at 9:30 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The purpose of the seminar is to connect readers and writers of crime fiction with medical and crime prevention professionals who can add veracity and provide basic information about real-life crime scenarios. Dr. William Hill of Southeast Louisiana Veterans Healthcare discusses suicide and PTSD at 9:30. Family nurse practitioner Ann Troy discusses forensic nursing at 11. Retired police officer and sketch artist Michael Verrett talks about homicide investigation and police sketching at 12:30. And at 2, memoirist Constance Adler presents a guided meditation for the creative process. Free and no registration. It's another full day of programming with children's book authors Saturday, June 23rd at Octavia Books. Dr. Chris Ferry signs his Baby University books at 10:30 a.m., followed by picture book authors Josh Funk, Lisa Judge, Miranda Paul, Baptiste Paul, and Camille Andros signing their books at 2. Then there will be a young adult author panel at 5, featuring Carolyn Mackler, Sarah Crossan, Brandy Colbert, Emily Pan, Jay Coles, and Monica Hess. All this again, Saturday at Octavia Books. Elise Gravel signs the Mushroom Fan Club and leads a mushroom drawing session, Sunday, June 24th at 2 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Public Library presents Hidden Figures in American Library History, the desegregation of public libraries in the Jim Crow South, civil rights, and local activism, with authors Wayne Wiegand, Shirley Wiegand, and library activist Ethel Sawyer Adolph of the Tougaloo Nine, who integrated the Jackson, Mississippi Library. Joan Madison Daniel, one of the Greenville Eight, who conducted a sit-in at the Greenville, South Carolina Public Library. Ibrahim Moomin, formerly Charlie Porter of the Columbus, Georgia Library Protest. And Robert A. Williams, one of 16 young people to conduct a sit-in at the Danville, Virginia Public Library. This discussion takes place Sunday, June 24th at 2 in the main library of the New Orleans Public Library. Alexis Marie Shute discusses and signs her new young adult fantasy, Above the Star, Sunday, June 24th at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harder Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.